I'd like to thank the organizers for the invitation. I'm going to talk about some recent work with Carlos Koenig. And the basic one that I'm interested in is the following. So assume that we are looking at the Schrodinger equation of the form IdT plus delta in x u is equal to v times u plus f of u. Whatever we put on the right-hand side, we can put various things on the right-hand side. This is the like the some level of generality at which I'm gonna show this. So what we have here, we have t is the time variable is a real variable, and x is the space variable is in Rn. So the function is defined on R cross Rn. V is a potential. And a good way to think of it is V is a potential that may be rough as well, so may have singularities. One possible example is the class Ln plus 2 over 2 in XnT. So it's a potential that may depend on time as well. It depends both on X and on the variable X and the time. And this is one exponent that that would work, and f is a non-linear term. And what I mean by a non-linear term, some examples are of the form u times absolute value of u to some power. That's a very classical example. And what we want to do, this is a pretty general. One thing that I want to point out is that we don't allow gradient terms in the right-hand side, so we don't allow the nonlinear term, for example, to depend on the gradient. And the question, so let's call this equation star. And the type of question the type of uniqueness question that we're interested in is the following. So assume that the question is assume that we have two solutions of the equation star. So assume u1 and u2 are functions that are from the interval 0, 1, continuous from the interval 0, 1 to L2 of Rn, and they solve star. It will turn out that they will have to be, let's put intersected Q with some other space, S of 0, 1. So the solution that they are looking at are both continuous from the interval 0, 1, and they will have an additional property. And then we also assume that u1 at time 0 agrees, so u1 of x0 is equal to u2 of x0 if x is in some domain D. And the same thing happens at time 1. So you assume that u1 of x1 is equal to u2 of x1 if x is in D. So the picture is that at these two different times we have a certain set, let's say a half space here, such that u1 is equal to u2 at the two different times. And then the question that we want to ask, so then the conclusion that we want to have is that u1 has to be identically equal to u2 throughout. So we know that the solutions agree at two different times, and we want to be able to say that they agree for all times between 0 and 1 and in the entire space Rn. So that's the type of question. Basically, what we want to there are many parameters here. So one thing that we have to figure out is what is this space. Then we also have to figure out for what kind of potentials does this work, and also for what kind of linearities does this work. So there are these three parameters that we want to understand. They turn out to be all related, and under those assumptions, we want to understand when do we have this type of uniqueness. Now, to understand this a little bit better, let's look at one example, which is when we have the free evolution. So we don't have any right-hand side. So we have IdT plus delta x. U is 0. So then if we have the free evolution, then because there is no non-linearity, we could have subtracted the two solutions. So then basically what we know, so then the question is equivalent to saying that we know that U is equal to 0 in D. So U at time 0 and U at time 1 is equal to 0 in some domain D. Then does this imply that U is identically equal to 0? So for the free evolution, we have a simple problem that simply says that if we know that a solution is 0 in some set here and in some set here, then it should have been, it should be 0 throughout. And this has to do with the infinite speed of propagation. So the easy way to think of this is that the solutions of the free equation have the infinite speed of propagation. What I mean by this is assume that we had, like, for example, the wave equation, and of course the answer would be false. So if U was compactly supported originally, then at any other time it had been compactly supported. So you couldn't say, so it would agree with zero at two different times outside the compact support. So I wouldn't be able to say that U is zero. But it turns out that solutions to the Schrödinger equation have the infinite speed of propagation. This is the kernel is with some normalizations. The kernel is a constant times t to the minus n over 2 times e to the I x squared divided by 4t. So if one was to start with a bump with the delta function at the origin, this would be the solution. And we see that at any time, like immediately, it propagates throughout the entire space. So that this is not compactly supported at any time. So basically, what in this case, let's say that we knew that the domain D that was the complement of a ball of radius R. So what the theorem would say in this case is if we have a solution that is equal to zero in a complement of a fixed ball at two different times, then it has to be equal to zero. And I want to show a very simple argument why that's so. So in this case, we know that U is equal to 0 at times t is equal to 0 and 1, and is equal to 0 in a complement of a ball. Then I want to be able to say that U is identically equal to 0. And this is very easy to see by using analytic functions. For example, in dimension n is equal to 1, we have, so let's say that we let f to be the Fourier transform of u at time 0. Now, u at time 0 is a function that's smooth and compactly it's compactly supported. So the Fourier transform is an analytic function. And it's also of a certain exponential type. So we have that f of z is bounded by a constant times e to the r, the imaginary part of z. And also the Fourier transform, so f times e to the I c squared is the Fourier transform of u1, because the Fourier transform of the function u at time 1 is simply multiplication by e to the I c squared. So basically what we would know is that we have, so if it was compactly supported at time 1 as well, then we'd have that f of z times e to the I z squared is also bounded by the same, so constant times e to the r imaginary part of z. So then if we work with this two, and we also know that f is an analytic function, so we can put for example an I z squared over 2 here by multiplying by, just to make it symmetric. So just to make it symmetric, we could have put an e to the I z squared over 2, and here we'd have e to the minus I z squared over 2. And then we expand the absolute value. There's only one term here that matters. And what one would get is that if one expands it, then we have these two lines, r and minus r. And our function f would have to be bounded by 1 on this line, bounded by 1 on this line, and decays very fast, decays exponentially away from So, so here it decays exponentially, and same here it decays exponentially. So the only way this can happen is if the function f was zero, because it's also analytic. It doesn't blow up. There is no problem. It's reasonable at this type of infinity. So so then the function f would be zero. So this would mean that u is zero. So now this gives a very easy proof in the case when we are in dimension one. Although this doesn't matter. Dimension is one, and if we have the free evolution. Now this type of proof. This proof is taken from a paper of Burger. So this type of question was addressed by Burger, and this the proof is actually taken from there. Although what he does there is a lot more complicated, because he considers the nonlinear. He doesn't allow potentials, but he considers nonlinear terms of the form f of u and u bar, and the reason why one would want to write in the form f of u and u bar is because this would have to be a polynomial in u and u bar. So he basically solves the problem for so he answers the question for the case when the nonlinear term is a polynomial of u and u bar, and again he uses this type of analytic methods. There's one more assumption that he makes, which is that the function is zero not only at the two times, but also in between, outside the complex set. So then it can be made zero inside. And he also says that it works for functions u that are for functions f that are analytic in u and u bar. This was earlier. So earlier there was work of Zhang. B.Y. Zhang, who answered the same question, the case n is equal to 1, and the function f of u and u bar in his case was a constant times u squared. So this u squared has to do with the fact that n is equal to 1. So this was the main problem that they were this was the main problem that started this subject. So the case Yeah, but this was earlier though. So this was in the early 90s. So Burgan's work is an extension of that. So and he used the inverse scattering theory. Now there's also some other work of Koenig, Pons, and Vega that's actually much closer to what I want to show. And this again, there is no potential in that there is no potential v, but for the function f, for the nonlinearity f, they assume that there is a bound of the form grad f of u bar is bounded by a constant times, to write exactly as they do, u to the p1 plus u to the p2. So again, this would apply for all polynomials, of course, because you have this kind of bounds. Now, what we want to do is basically a general theorem that already this theorem of Koenig-Pons and Vega shows that is not so important the analyticity of the nonlinearity. It's really just a bound for the first term that one needs. So what we want is to have a more general theory that would cover this case, and also would cover more general equations, also with potential and possible singularities in the potential, and also in the nonlinearity. So now I'm gonna leave this board. What we do is linearize the problem. So we have the original equations I dt plus delta x u is equal to v times u plus f of u. And we know that this holds for u1 and u2. So basically what we do is linearize the problem. So we let u is equal to u1 minus u2. So then we have, so then the equation becomes I dt plus delta u is equal to w times u. And what we have for w, when we write this down, for w we have, so w is equal to v plus f of u1 minus f of u2 divided by u1 minus u2. So the assumptions that we are going to make, we are going to make assumptions on w. So now we have, we deal with this equation, I dt plus delta u is w times u. We think of it as an equation, we think of w depends on u, but we think of it as an independent quantity. And so whatever condition we assume for v is going to be the same condition that we assume for this function. So just to define this thing, let's say that there is a function g. So the property that g of u1 plus g of u2 is bigger or equal than absolute value of f of u1 minus f of u2 divided by u1 minus u2. I mean, this is actually for any complex numbers. G of z1, z2, z1, z2. So the assumptions that we make are going to depend on the function g, on the function g of u1, g of u2, and v. So basically the theorem that we prove is of the following type. We assume that u1 and u2 are in the same as in the question, so they are functions that are continuous from the interval 0, 1 to L2 of Rn, and they also agree on an open set. And we assume that they agree is a half space. This is the smallest domain that that we're able to have a theorem. So the domain on which we assume the function agrees is a half space, and we also assume that v plus g of u1 plus g of u2 belongs to some space Y. So you assume that the potential and also this derivative of f is, you know, these are in fact, so this is the condition of the potential, this is the condition on u1 and u2, so they are basically the conditions I'm looking at there in s of 0, 1. So these conditions correspond to where do the functions u live. And so then under these assumptions, we want to prove that we have the uniqueness. Question one. Now, what I mainly have to do is define the space Y, and basically I have to define it in a natural way. So it turns out that the space Y is a very natural space that we have to put here. There is one, in fact, it's absolutely sharp, and it's a very natural way to define it, starting from the Stricart estimate. So I'm going to do this as a parenthesis, just to get to define the correct space. So start the Stricart estimates. So the Stricart estimates, they are very useful, and they are not only for the Schrodinger. I'm only going to discuss the ones that are for the Schrodinger equation. So for the Schrodinger equation, they have the follow. There again are various ways of stating them, but the way I'm going to need them is in the form. So let's say that we have an equation of the form I dt plus delta u is equal to f, and let's say that u is smooth and compactly supported. Then the Stricart estimate says that the norm of u in LP prime T, LQ prime X, let's say P2 prime, Q2 prime, is bounded by the norm, some constant, C bar. This constant will appear throughout. This is the constant, the main constant is Stricart estimates times the norm of F in L of P1 T, L of Q1 X. And for this to, these are mixed norms in the sense that you first take, so if you have a function in the time and in x, then for each you fix the time, you take the corresponding norm in x, and then you take the other norm in the time. So that's the way these spaces work. And for this to hold, this can only hold for some types of exponents, which are, so for P1 over Q1, we need the condition that 2 over P1 plus N over Q1 is equal to N plus 4 over 2. And also the P1 and Q1 are in the interval 1, 2. So these are small exponents. And for P2 and Q2, so P2 prime and Q2 prime, Q2 prime, that's equal to N over 2, and they are big exponents. Q2 prime are in 2 infinity. The numerology here comes from the scaling. So one has to think that the time, although there's only one derivative in the time variable that has the same strength as two derivatives in X, so then the time variable has homogeneity 2, so then there's one time variable of homogeneity 2, so we have the 2, and there are n space variables, each one with homogeneity 1, so we have the n here. So for this type of exponents, we have the Strickland estimate. This goes back, the Strickland estimates go back a long time to the work of Strickland, and they're not only for Schrodinger equations, they're also for wave equations, and they are very useful when trying to do estimates for these equations. So again, they go back a long time, except for one endpoint that was a little bit harder, which was recently solved by Keel and Tao. And it corresponds to the case when P1 is equal to P2 prime is equal to 2, and then the other exponents are forced here, so they are Q1. So the Q1 is 2n over n plus 2, and Q2 prime is 2n over n minus 2, and this is only when n is bigger or equal than 3. In dimension 2, there is no endpoint, and in dimension below 1, then already the conditions that P1 and Q1 are small, that they already make sure that this is not possible. So now, these are the Strickland estimates for this equation, and there's another way of writing them because it is written here, there are lots of Strickland estimates, and our theorem somehow should take them all into account. It turns out it's actually easier to prove a theorem that takes all the estimates into account than proving the theorem to take only one estimate. Because when we build the parametrics, the error terms, it's easier to deal with them if we have the full Strickland estimate. So the reason for this is, so we have these estimates from all the possible right-hand side to all the possible left-hand side. So basically what we do, we define the space X prime to be the intersection of all the Strickland estimates for the P2 prime and Q2 prime, and they're also interpolation spaces because of the connection. So this is equal, so the intersection turns out to be n infinity t L to x intersected with L two t, and then we have this L two n over n minus 2x. I'm going to assume from now on that dimension is bigger or equal than 3. It's the harder case, and otherwise one has to change the exponents a little bit. So this is the space x prime, and the space x, because you can have any part in the right-hand side. For the space X, you have to take the union of all the Strickland spaces for which we have it. And the union is a Banach space, so we have to take the sum of the two. So this is L1T L to X plus L to T L 2N over N plus 2X. So these are the two spaces that we work with, and then the Strickland estimate simply becomes that the normal view in X prime is bounded by this constant C bar times the norm of F in X. So these are the right space to consider for the Strickland estimate. So now the space Y that we defined here is a space that makes the connection between X and X prime. So Y is going to be L1T L infinity X plus L infinity T L N over 2X. So the space Y is going to have some component. This is one part is going to be bounded in X, but more rough in T, and the other one can be rough in X and bounded in T. So this is the space Y. And the reason for choosing it is that now if we have the norm of A times B in X, that's always bounded by the norm of A in X prime times the norm of B in Y. So that's what I mean, that the space Y makes the connection between X and X prime. So this is the space Y that we have here. So we require that our potential and also these derivatives of U1 and U2 live in this space. And now I said that this space is natural and it's also sharp. So there's one other thing I want to point out to justify that. Which is that if we are looking at, so it has to do with the well-posedness of this equation. So if we are looking at, so another observation, if we are looking at the equation IDT plus delta U is equal to, let's say, WU, and if W is in the space Y, then the equation is well-posed. If W is anywhere outside the space Y, then the equation is ill-posed. So if W is in Y, but actually one needs a little bit more than just Y because of the term, the infinity term here, there is no smallness. So in order to be able to, even if you restrict time, the time to a very small slice, you cannot get smallness. So what I'm going to say is that W times the characteristic function of the interval, so let's say A minus epsilon A minus epsilon not A. So if this is, if the norm of this in Y is bounded by 1 over 2 C bar, so if there is an epsilon not such that this happens, then you have well-posedness. On the other hand, as soon as you're right outside, there's a counterexample. So in fact, you have a counterexample. Even without the smallness condition, you have a counterexample. So there is an example of W, which is in L infinity T, ln over 2x. So at each time T is in ln over 2, but where the equation is ill-posed. And of course, if you lower the T here, it will be even worse ill-posed. So this space is, all the spaces are local in time. So the exponent, if you lower the exponent, the space gets bigger. So, in the sense that there is a solution with U0 is equal to 0, and U is not always equal to 0. So there's a solution that starts from 0, and it's not going to stay 0. So this is the example. So now, this makes it clear. This space is. If one is to think of the problem in terms of this equation, which is just to the potential, then the correct space to consider is this space Y that connects between the, for which you have basically well posedness. I want to give a few ideas. I'm not gonna do the proof, but I want to give a few ideas of what's involved in the proof. So I'm gonna start. I'm going to talk. It turns out that the thing that makes it work is to work with the Carleman inequality. But I want to get there in a natural way. So let's say that we are looking at easy problem one, in which all the local assumptions are I make them global. So instead of saying that the function, I mean, this is a very silly problem, but. It sounds a lot more common than it is, but so instead of assuming that we have, for example, that the solution U is 0 in a half space, I'm going to assume that the solution U is 0 everywhere at both times, and instead of assuming that our quantity, our W is in the space Y, I'm going to assume that W is in the space Y and has small norm, not only small norm at infinity, which is what if it was in the space, but small norm throughout. So in this case, it's just the streetcar system that works. So another way of writing the streetcar system that I have over there is that the norm of u in x prime is bounded by this c bar times the norm of f in x plus. You can also cut, because of this, the way we define the space, you can cut for phi in the time in the time variable. So if the function u is not, if the function u, so basically what it says is that this is the norm of u naught in L2 plus the norm of u1 in L2. So this is x between 0 and 1. So this holds because you can cut for free the times between 0 and 1, and you just have to put the terms here. So now if we have this, then if we plug in, assuming that my functions u0 and u1 were 0 throughout, again, this is not very sure because you actually don't need the last term. But this is just because I eventually have to put weight, so then we'll need both terms. So this is just to show, to give an example here. So now assuming that we had the equation IDP plus delta u is equal to VU, to WU, then we can just plug this in here, so we tell that this is more than C bar times the norm of WU in X of 0, 1. And now, if I assume that U0 and U1 were 0 throughout, not just in half space, then this would be 0. Now, the norm of WU in X, this is bounded by C bar times the norm of W in Y times the norm of U in X prime. And now, so if I assume that the norm of W was small throughout, then with small than 1 over 2 C bar, then you can just absorb the term and you get that the norm of U in X prime is 0, so U is equal to 0. Okay, so this would be small or equal than 1 half times the norm of U in X prime. Then we get that this is 0. So this is the type of proof that we would like to do. This is extremely simple here. Now, what are the problems? The problems are that these terms are not going to be equal to 0, and also our W is in this space Y, but it doesn't have small norm. So here I needed that W had small norm. So what I want to show first is an inequality that's false. But that's something that would make sense if. So let's say that the Streetcar inequality was stronger than it is. So let's start from false Streetcar inequality. Which is basically this Streetcar inequality, and I'm going to pretend that I could localize it to a half space. It's not true. You cannot localize to half space, but let's pretend we had the inequality, the norm of u, the characteristic function of d times u in x prime is smaller than c bar times the norm of the characteristic function of d times f in x plus the norm of the characteristic function of d times u naught in L2 plus the norm of the characteristic function of d times u1 in L2. So let's pretend that we could have localized the Streetcar system to half space, then basically this proof would have gone through because I can just take the space D in such a way. I already know that U0 and U1 are 0 far enough, in half space far enough, so I just take D to be far enough. And then I can also assume, I also need to make sure that the norm of W is small, but again, because W is in this space Y, then if I take D again far enough, then I'm going to go below 1 half. So then if this was true, then this would give uniqueness. This is not true, and it's very far from being true. However, there is a way to make this work, and this is through the use of Carleman inequality. So a true Rickard's estimate, it's actually called the Kalemann inequality. Is when you cannot put the weight as nicely as here, so you can just cut off exactly the half space, but you can put a weight that in some sense does that. So you can put e to the beta x1 times u in x prime is bounded by this c bar times the norm of e to the beta x1 f in x plus the norm of e to the beta x1 u naught in L2 plus the norm of e to the beta x1 times u1 in L2. And this is a true inequality. So this is due to Kenny Hanzog. And what's important here is that this constant doesn't depend on beta. So the reason why it's called the Kalemann inequality is because the constant we have here doesn't depend on beta. So it's a uniform respect to beta. So this is for any beta in R. And in some sense, you can think, the way to think is that beta is very large. So in some sense, this kind of resembles the false Kalemann, the false Rickard estimate, because if beta is very large, then when x1 is negative, you could think that the weight is very small. When x1 is positive, the point is that when x1 is positive, you don't get exactly the characteristic function. You get something that blows up. But that's the correct way. This is false. This is true. So now using this, this Kalemann inequality could prove a second theorem that's, again, an easy theorem and doesn't give them the problem. So, second easy theorem. So the second easy theorem is that we do have uniqueness, but under the assumption the functions u decay faster than exponential. So uniqueness holds. If there's going to be a very strong condition on u, that's going to become clear when I start showing the proof. So now let's to see how that works using this Kalemann inequality. So what we do, we just plug in as before. For f, we just plug in wu, and we take out the term. So we have that the norm of e to the beta x1 u in x prime, and I'm going to divide this into two parts, x prime of x1 big and x1 small. So x1 small equal then some number b plus the norm of e to the beta x1 u of x prime, and then I have x1 bigger than b. X1, the reason for choosing x1 is because that's the variable in the weight. So then this would have to be small or equal than c bar, and then I break up all these other terms the same way. So you have the norm of e to the beta x1 f, so f is w times u, so we break it up, so that's so it's w. Again, I break up everything, so this the norm of u in x prime of x1 bigger equal than b times the norm of w in y of x1 bigger equal than b, and this turns out to be the main term. There are various other terms. Now, all the other terms, if I take b to be large enough, u0 and u1 are going to vanish for x1 bigger than b. So all the other terms are going to be terms in which x1, they're going to be terms in which x1 is smaller than b. Because in all the other terms, for example, we have another term here when x1 is bigger than b, but u0 is 0, because we already assumed that u0 and u1 were 0 when in a half space. So if we take b large enough, then all the other terms are supporting when x1 is smaller than b. So now the question is, how do we choose b? We simply have to choose b in such a way that this term is smaller than 1 over 2 c bar. Now, if this term is smaller than 1 over 2 c bar, then this term can be absorbed into this term. Because we'd have 1 half, so we could absorb this term into here. And then what we get is that e to the beta x1 u for x1 bigger than this b is smaller than stuff that happens for x1 smaller than this b. Another point is that we can let beta tend to infinity. The constant didn't change with beta, so we can let beta tend to infinity. So then we would get a contradiction, because we have something. I mean, we would get that u has to be equal to 0 when x1 is bigger than b, because otherwise we can just let beta we can let it tend to infinity. Now there's one major problem with this argument, which is this absorption here. So the inequality that we have here is something of the form some unknown quantity is smaller than 1 plus 1 half times the unknown quantity. So if the unknown quantity was finite, then we could have absorbed it. But if it's not finite, then if this term here is equal to infinity, then this would be equal to infinity, so we wouldn't be able to absorb. So that there is nothing happened. And you can see that, unfortunately, because beta is supposed to be large, this could very well be equal to infinity, because x1 is big and beta is large. So then the only way to take care of that is if we assume that the function u had very rapid decay. So if we assume that u times e to the nx was still to belong to this x prime. So using this Kalman inequality of Kenny Hensel, one is only able to prove the uniqueness, but in the class of functions that already have fast and exponential decay. Now you might think that that's the kind of thing one can get around, the fact that you have to subtract the infinity. That's not. That's actually the main thing that happens with Kalman inequality. It's easy to prove. This is a very easy Kalman inequality. This is very easy to prove, and it's easy to prove Kalman inequality in which the weights blow up very fast, particularly in a convex way, but then they can only be applied to functions that decay correspondingly. So they can only be applied to fewer functions. Now, what we need in order to be able to run this argument is we need a stronger Kalman inequality. Which is actually our main theorem, so strong Kalman inequality. Which says the following, which says that we have an inequality, so we have an inequality of the form e to the beta phi lambda of x1 u in this space x prime is bounded by some constant times the norm of e to the beta phi lambda of x1 idt plus delta u in x plus the norm of e to the beta phi lambda of x1 times u naught in L2 plus the norm of e to the beta phi lambda of x1 u1 in L2. And I have to tell you what this phi lambda is. So phi lambda is basically a function that's phi lambda of x1 is basically x1 if x1 is more or equal than lambda, and it's a certain constant of phi lambda if x1 is bigger than lambda. So what's supposed to be is a function that grows up like x, and at some point stops growing and it becomes finite. And lambda is supposed to be much bigger than beta. In fact, much bigger than the power of beta. So lambda is bigger than beta to the 6 for this to hold. So then our main claim is that we have this inequality for lambda large enough compared to beta, for any beta, and the point is this constant C doesn't depend on neither lambda nor beta nor the function u nor anything, with an absolute uniform constant. And now, if we had this inequality, then this argument would go through nicely, because we can basically do the same thing with this weight, and this absorption that we did here is legitimate, because the function u, this function phi lambda is is bounded, so the weight is bounded, so everything becomes a legitimate absorption. So then this argument goes through. Now what we did, basically, we moved all the difficulty in the Carleman inequality, because now the Carleman inequality is not easy anymore, because we have the weight is not convex, it's actually has this concavity here. So that the Carleman inequality becomes harder to prove. And however, this Carleman inequality applies. And now I just have a couple of more minutes. I'm just going to give a very quick idea of how to prove this. It turns out that there's one other thing that's important about this Carleman inequality, is the fact that everything is local in time. In the Tricard's estimates, the constant didn't depend on the fact that the time that we were looking at was between 0 and 1. And the same also in the Carleman inequality of Kenyes and Zog, this constant, there's a scaling that goes through, so it doesn't matter. 0 and 1 doesn't matter. Here, however, there's no more scaling, and this constant depends on the distance between the two times. So that's one thing to keep in mind, that the time is kept fixed. Now, to prove the strong Carleman inequality, we think of the evolution in three ways. So the evolution. So basically, what we do, we think that IDT plus delta U is equal to F, and we want to understand U in terms of F. But I have to keep in mind, I have to put the weight. So because of this, the evolution, you have to think of the evolution, not just the regular evolution, but in other ways. So the evolution, we think of evolution in three ways. So there's basically a forward evolution in time. There's also a backwards evolution in time. That's already very natural to expect, because the fact that that's the way to use, that we had assumptions at time 0 and time 1. So whatever happens forward, we have to, there's a dual thing that happens backwards. And also there's a forward evolution in x1. So in one of the Fourier regimes, this is something that has to do with proving Carleman inequalities, because the Carleman inequalities depend, it's important to get the constant independent, for example, of beta. You want to think of the variable x1 as a special variable compared to the others, and solve the equation as if it is an evolution in x1. So that's what we do, and there are basically three Fourier regimes that. So basically, what we do, we look at the conjugated function in the Fourier space, and there are three regimes, and in each one of these regimes, we think of the equation as an evolution in the corresponding direction, and then we build the parametrices. And then I have to prove the parametrics are bounded from x to x prime, and there are some error terms that have to be controlled. So that's the basic idea of proving of having the proof. So I'm going to stop here. Thanks. We think of the problem as a wave equation. So in some regime, basically, forward evolution x1 means that we write the equation in the form dx1 2. So dx1 2, and then we have the other variables, which are idt plus dx prime 2, u is equal to f. And then we take the Fourier transform here. So then this becomes dx1 2 plus tau plus c prime squared u tilde is equal to f tilde. So then basically what we do, we think of this as a wave equation in x1. So we write the solution. So basically we'll have a solution of u tilde in terms of, as if this was a wave equation in x1. This will only work when this parameter has the right sign, and also it has to have some size as well. I didn't write down exactly what are the Fourier regimes here. But in some regime, we think of the equation as a wave equation in X1.